Hello and welcome to the Answers for Cancers podcast. I am your host, Anne-Marie Fay.
And I'm Michelle Matthews.
Together with some of Ireland's leading experts, we want to unravel what it truly means to have cancer.
From consultant diagnosis to treatment plans, from managing your symptoms to supports available, we have it covered. So whether you're a nurse working in oncology or have been personally affected by cancer, this podcast is for you. The Answers for Cancers podcast is sponsored by Care Plus Pharmacy. Care Plus Pharmacy is Ireland's leading community pharmacy brand, offering expert advice and services for a healthier and happier you. Find your nearest Care Plus on www.careplus.ie or follow them on social media for health and wellness inspiration and tips.
Mary Scarfe is a psychotherapist and has worked with ARC since its establishment in 1994. One of her roles there is to facilitate the stress management course. She joins us today to chat about the neuroscience behind stress, what can trigger it, and some useful tips and coping mechanisms we can adapt to help us manage our stress better. Thanks, Mary, for joining us today. I know that we really learned a lot and we hope that our listeners do too. Enjoy.
So, Mary, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today about stress management. I think it's really important and it's definitely been a very much requested topic on our podcast so far. So thank you so much. Would you mind just telling us a little bit about yourself and your work with ARC?
Sure, and I'm delighted to be here, and I'm hoping that what I might give here might be helpful to people. I'm a psychotherapist, okay, a trauma therapist, a relationship therapist, and a supervisor, and I've been working with ARC since it started way back in 1994, and I work there as a psychotherapist, a counsellor, and I also facilitate the stress management program there as well. And I'm also a supervisor to the therapists and volunteers there.
Wow. Oh, amazing. So you have a wealth of knowledge. So we're absolutely delighted to have you. So Mary, we might start just by defining stress and its impact it can have on the body.
Yeah, and I'm probably just going to give you a kind of an overview of my course in the stress management. And it really is just to maybe to define stress by Hans Selye, who in 1936 said that the term stress, as we currently use it, can be defined as a non-specific response of the body to any demand or any change. Okay. And so he went on to say further that stress is the rate of wear and tear on your body. So your body is a good indication of how you're managing stress. But he also went on to say that any changes in your life will cause stress. So that stress is always with us. We need a certain amount of it to function properly, you know. And so therefore, both too little and too much stress can cause problems. So in other words, if you have too little stress, you know, and you're bored, that can be as stressful as too many demands on your stress, okay? But my favorite definition of stress is this. It's a psychological damaging condition resulting from the conscious suppression of the biological need to physically choke the living shit out of some asshole who really deserves it.
I was not expecting that.
And you can see why it's my favorite definition.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, you know, I think, you know, we all on a constant basis experience this. Yeah. And if we can see it in connection with the definition of stress, you know, it's, you know, a physical expression. So in other words, I want to beat the shit out of somebody. So in other words, I get the impulse in my body to do that, but the impulse is inhibited.
Yeah.
Okay. And because the impulse is inhibited, because we no longer can beat the shit out of even the dog or the cat anymore, but that's our impulse, okay, is that when that gets inhibited, then we have tension in the body.
Mm.
And that's why stress causes tension in the body. And you can see it, it's, you know, mostly in your shoulders or in your legs or in your feet or you know, you want to kick or you want to punch or whatever. And it's also a psychological, you know, sort of a condition because, you know, you have a very strong emotion and you can't vent that emotion. Okay, so what you do is you hold on to the emotion. And in holding on to the emotion, this is what we call reactive depression.
Okay. Okay.
And there is your psychological damaging, you know, sort of condition. Okay. And so what we do need to you know, do in stress, which we'll be talking about a little bit more, is to look up at this, you know, to look at stress in this way, both as a psychological piece and both as a physical piece. And that's why, you know, going to the gym, you know, playing sort of, you know, sports, going for the walk, going for the run is a good stress management technique. Okay. And why, you know, going to see a counselor when you find that you're holding on to a lot of emotions here. That's why going to a counselor and being able to talk about what's going on for you is a good way of managing stress. Okay. Mm-hmm. So let's go on from that. And another kind of definition, excuse me. Another, you know, definition of stress would be, you know, it's like a zebra losing its stripes. It's unraveling. And what often happens to us when we're stressed is that we unravel. Mm-hmm. We no longer know who we are. We can no longer depend on our ability to cope in the same way as we were before. And so that's another definition of stress. Okay. Mm-hmm. But there is so much, there's so much research has been done on stress since Hans Selye. And, you know, I've been involved with this on a course that I did, a trauma therapy course I did with Peter Levine. And I want to share some of that information with you as well. We'll start by actually saying to you is that we come under the false impression that events are what causes us stress. Okay. But it's not the event that causes us stress. It's our reaction and interpretation of the event that causes us stress. And that's why we can manage stress better, because we have absolutely no control or limited control over the events that happen in our lives. But what we do have is that we can, in some way, control our reaction and our interpretation of stress. Okay. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we need, therefore, to go into and have a really deep understanding of the what I will call the evolutionary hierarchy of the nervous system. And this is what we're finding out now in neuroscientists and within neuroscientists. And if we kind of look at what happens to us when something unfamiliar happens in our lives, okay? Because we will go through this hierarchy of evolution. And the first thing we will do is we will have a tendency to want to go into social engagement. We will want to go into a safe place where we can process what the unfamiliar thing is, okay? But if that's not available to us, then our next sort of way of working with it is to go into the fight and flight response. And this is, you know, coming from our reptilian brain, okay? If we get so overwhelmed, in other words, we can't fight this or we can't run from this, we will go into what we call shutdown, okay? Mm-hmm. And so what I want to talk to you, around, you know, today on this podcast is actually, you know, looking at these three different nervous system responses so that you can understand them. And in understanding them, then you can work with them better. Okay. So let's start with the fight and flight one. Okay. In a healthy nervous system, okay, we will automatically get aroused. And then as we get aroused, we will actually, you know, sort of, as I call it, we put the brake on and then we will settle again. Mm-hmm. So as we go through our day, this is what's happening all the time. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you can see probably easier in animals. They graze, they hear a small little noise, they turn around and it's a mouse. So it doesn't bother them and they go and graze again. And so we do more or less the same thing. Okay. But then what can happen to us is that, you know, a stressor comes on, a threat comes on, a change comes upon us, okay? And that is no longer, you know, available. This is not enough, okay? And so we have a thing in our brain called the hypothalamus. It's like a radar system. And it knows that something has changed. Mm-hmm. And because something has changed, you know, it automatically alerts our autonomic nervous system, okay. And it's called that for that reason. It's so automatic that we're not even conscious at this moment in time. It then hits the sympathetic nerves, and it also hits the adrenal medulla and secretes adrenaline. And we kind of know that word, adrenaline. Okay. But we need to also understand what the sympathetic nerves do. Okay. And they are connected to various different organs in our body. They increase our heartbeat, so that now our heart is pumping a lot of blood around with a lot of oxygen, a lot of vitamins, okay, a lot of nourishment that our body needs very, very quickly. It's interesting also, at the same time, there's a clotting agent released because the body now in its wisdom thinks, oh my God, we're going to be wounded, okay. Muscles contract because now we're either going to fight, okay, or we're going to run. Mm-hmm. The other interesting thing is that enzyme production in the stomach is decreased because our body in its wisdom knows that, okay, we don't need to eat now. Okay. It's like we're, in a war zone, and just imagine a ship in a war zone. Nobody's in the canteen. They're all at the places, that they need to be at. And so our body is working on the same principle. So what we might experience is we've no appetite, or that we've eaten, but we're not digesting our food, okay? And, some people, researchers have also said that what we might experience at that stage is that butterfly experience in our stomach, which means that the blood has been rerouted to other areas in our body, like our muscles, so that we can fight, okay? The liver also produces extra energy that it stores in case we might need it. And that's why when we're in this fight and flight response, we can probably run faster than we did before, lift things that we never did before, as well. We have a lot more energy very, very quickly. And then also urine production is changing. So we pee a lot, and some of us have diarrhea as well. And then we sweat because our whole system is now heating up. And one way the body has of cooling down is to sweat. And also we breathe much quicker because we need a lot more oxygen in our system in order to get this response really going. So if you can look at it as a good response, it's giving us a lot of energy to cope with what our body is experiencing is a change. Okay. And if we can see it as that, then we're working with it. But unfortunately, what happens to us now is that we've adapted the system, because in the animals it was just perfect. You got this energy, you went out, you either ran or you fought, and that was it. But for us humans, life got a little bit more complicated. Our predators were invisible now. Okay. And so we adapted a system to this. And the adaptation here is that the pituitary gland now kicks in. So in other words, when this nervous system that is so quick, okay, when that's not enough, okay, or the stressor doesn't go away, then what happens is the pituitary gland is now activated and it secretes this stress hormone called cortisol. Mm-hmm. Okay. So if you can see, this is the reaction in the body. Okay. And so if that's the reaction in the body that's occurring on a constant basis, you can understand then that something has to adapt to this. And unfortunately, what adapts to this is our immune system. And our immune system then gets suppressed or compromised. Mm-hmm. And this is the connection between stress and illness.
Wow, so physical, isn't it?
Yeah.
I went into that detail because I think, like you said, like it's understanding it that's where the power is, isn't it? That you can change it, and understanding the symptoms as it manifests in the body. But I also think, like you say, it's the overstimulation of that causes the issues. But I think like what you said at the start is so important as well, because I think stress gets such a bad rep as well. And like you said, you do need a little bit of stress to function properly. So it's trying to get the balance of the two, isn't it? Absolutely.
That if we see this response as a good response, okay, rather than what we actually have a tendency to do, is we call it anxiety.
Yeah.
And you know, I've often wondered why in the heck do we call it anxiety when in actual fact the body's just giving us the energy to cope with something that's yeah. changing. Mm-hmm. And you know, my sense of it is that we've learned this as a young kid. Okay, yes. That when we got this response, we might have had a response from our parents saying, oh, hey, Mary, are you anxious about going and doing this tomorrow? Yeah. In actual fact, I was excited about doing that. But I've now just labeled this experience as anxiety rather than excitement. And, you know, there's a lot of research done on that in connection with students that's playing this one out. Okay.
I feel like that I've had that thought for a long time, that we label anxiety for a lot of different things, and mm-hmm. sometimes not in every case, but I think sometimes it can be damaging, can't it? Because it kind of just labels things, and then it's not really understanding that actually it could just be a stressor on that particular day, and you're just experiencing that at that particular time. You may not necessarily have anxiety. Sure.
Well, in actual fact, now what you know, and I might be I'll talk about this in a few minutes. That might you know underline this. It is just to realize now you've become your own threat.
Yeah.
Because now you're saying I'm anxious, okay, and now you're actually connecting with the limbic brain that says, oh no, I better be anxious because something is going to happen. So now you're feeding yourself. Does that make sense? You're actually feeding this response.
Yeah, absolutely. And not actually, I suppose, trying to do anything to calm yourself down. It's actually spiraling it even worse.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So
I think it's very important to realize that stress doesn't cause you to be ill. What stress does, it has an impact on your immune system. Mm-hmm. So therefore, that's another way of managing your stress. Does that make sense? In the sense that we're all going to have stressful events in our lives and stressful periods in your life. Mm-hmm. So what we need to do is to know, okay, my immune system now could be compromised. So what do I do to nourish my immune system so that I can cope with this? And then when the stressful event is over, can I bring myself down into what we call homeostasis, calmness, so that my whole system now can rest? Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's a way of managing it.
Yeah, I think it's really important, because I think oftentimes what I find talking to people, there's a little bit of a misconception that stress is only psychological, you know. Mm-hmm. I think the body sometimes can get missed. So yeah, thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah. Because I mean, you know, often, you know, cancer patients will get the all clear, and then the last word is said to them going out, now don't get stressed. Okay. Yeah. So what do they do? They get stressed about being stressed.
Yes.
Okay. You know, so rather than saying, no, I can manage this. Mm-hmm. I can manage this. Okay. Yeah.
It's interesting that you say stress doesn't make you sick as well, because I think a lot of times people can say, I know I am sick, it's because I'm so stressed, you know? Mm. And it's like they're linked together.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And they're almost convincing themselves. Yeah. You know what I mean? Rather than as you said, you know, that this is a response, is a great response, you know. It gives us the energy in order to cope with something that our body needs right now to cope with whatever that change has occurred, you know.
I suppose touching off that, I suppose we all have different coping mechanisms, but why is it that we don't all get stressed out with the same things in our lives?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting you know thing, and it is about knowing, you know, in the sense that, you know, let's go back to our limbic brain again. Okay, our limbic brain, you know, we've got a triune brain. We've got the neocortex of brain, okay, which is what we would call the executive brain. It's when we take in new information. We've got the limbic brain, okay, which is our emotional brain. And in our emotional brain, we hold all of our memories. It's got the seat of our fear is in there, okay? But it's all the patterns and, you know, your behavior that we have learned over a period of time, okay? And then we have the reptilian brain, which is what we've been talking about right now. And we also need to know that when we come into this world, we come in with personality traits. you know, from our tribes. Does that make sense? We may not have inherited from our mother, but we might have inherited from our grandmother. Does that make sense? So we all come in with personality traits, okay? And so therefore, you know, my siblings may not get stressed out with the same thing as I do, okay? Mm-hmm. And what we do know, again, with research is that there is three personality traits that we know lead into stress. Okay, those personality traits are the worrier, okay, the critic, the perfectionist, okay, and the victim.
Okay.
All right. And you know, if you look at you know what these four might say to you, I mean, I'm telling you, you've got voices in your head, okay, but you're not schizophrenic. But there's something constantly tells you things in your head. Would you agree with that? Yeah, absolutely. So if you take the worrier, it will tell you, you know, what if, okay? If you look at the critic, it will tell you that you are stupid. If you look at the perfectionist, it will tell you, I should, I must, or I have to do something. And if you look at the victim, you know, the words there would be, I am overwhelmed or I cannot cope, all right? So, you know, if you look at the, you know, in answer to your question, okay, so what I'm saying to you here is that we one of us might have a more intense worrier than somebody else. Does that make sense? Or, you know, yeah. I might interpret my world from a whole different perspective because that's who I am. So that's why when I interpret a stressor, I might interpret it totally different than you. And that's why I get stressed out more than somebody else.
Okay.
And I don't know if that answers that question for you.
Yeah, the only question I have is that did you say that these are like personality traits that we kind of inherit? It's not, is it, would your environment have anything to do with that or the people you're around?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, you will come into this world with a sensitivity to it and then it's modeled for you.
Yeah.
So your environment will, and you know, what we know now is that we're constantly, you know, sort of programming ourselves right up until we're 20. Up to say maybe, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, they stopped at 3. Does that make sense? But now we know, you know, up to about 20, you're still being influenced by your external environment. So if you grew up in an environment, you know, that was critical, and now we're taking into account schooling, college, secondary school. So we're opening ourselves to all kinds of environments now that we may actually have models of somebody criticizing us, somebody saying you should be doing this or you're not doing it, you know, you should be doing better. So we're much more open to all of that now than we would have been before.
I think even listening to you there, people might even try to start listening to those voices and get a sense of what's actually there, if it's a worry.
Sure.
Critic or a victim or whatever, and I think that's so powerful to even just become aware of them, because then you can kind of start to maybe trying to harness them a little bit.
And that's the way to manage them, is to challenge them, and this is what we do in the stress management course, is that we look at ways of helping, you know, the people on the course to manage these four specifically, and we have open discussions around it. I mean, subjectively I have all four. Okay, I will have the critic telling you you're stupid, the perfectionist will tell you you should be doing better, the worry will tell you there's a consequences to that, and then you get overwhelmed.
Yeah.
So they form teams. Like if you have one, the chances are you have all four, and they're kind of whispering in each other's ear. Does that make sense? And one of the ways that, you know, that I myself in when I was, you know, training as a therapist, that helped me to sort of really look at this in some way, was I now imagine that my psychic is a bus. And when I wake up in the morning, I ask myself the question, who's driving my bus today? Yeah. Because the chances are one of them has already started. Okay. Yeah. And when you can do that, then you can sort of say to yourself, well, who else do I have in my bus to drive today?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I also, you know, when I was growing up, I was, you know, in an environment that was very creative. So I can be creative. I can be objective. Does that make sense? I can be funny. Yeah. I can, you know, I can be spontaneous, but how often do these parts of myself get a chance to play into it? All right. And so it's about asking myself the question, well, who would I like to drive my bus today?
Yeah, absolutely. So simple. I think it's great that you, when you give them actual kind of nearly names and you make them out to be different people, because then it makes you feel like actually I'm not the critic or I'm not the victim. Yeah. Like, these are good parts of my personality, not my only personality.
I really think that's a very important thing to say, that you know, this isn't my whole potential.
Yeah.
And what is my whole potential?
I love the bus. I think that's brilliant.
Because, you know, I could have the creative side on my bus, but it's under the seat. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because the critic won't allow it to come up and drive the bus. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes it's just recognizing it, isn't it? It's just listening. I listened to something really interesting before, and it was saying the same thing, like when those thoughts come into your head, it's your own brain telling you these things.
Yeah.
And they said, name it a friend, and they named it, I think it was Becky. And they said, would you ever let your friend speak to you like that? No, you wouldn't. So why are you letting your brain speak to you like that?
And I really think that a very important piece of this is to go back into what I said about the hierarchy of evolution of how our body responds, because, you know, what we're beginning to notice now is that, you know, when a person is diagnosed with cancer, okay, they're not in a place where they can have social engagement. You know, I'd love to say that that people think hospitals are safe. They feel they're safe, you know, on a medical way, but emotionally people are very anxious in hospital. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? So it's not a place where they can feel that they can have social engagement. And oftentimes when they're being diagnosed with cancer, okay, what they're being diagnosed by a consultant, and they're often on their own, especially in COVID. COVID has really played a huge part in this. And so what happens to them then is now they can't fight the consultant. Yeah. Okay, which a lot of them would, I'd say, but they can't run. They're trapped. Does that make sense? And so now what happens is they get overwhelmed and they shut down.
Yeah.
Okay. And the shutdown, you know, is the way that they experience shutdown is, I call it functional freeze. It's like, I'm here and I'm functioning, but I don't have the emotions.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? And that's what you might be experiencing in them for a long period of time, even going through their treatment. Okay, yeah. They're in this functional freeze because it's their survival mechanism. It's what animals do as well, you know, and they play dead, because if they play dead, then the predator won't eat dead meat. But in 2 hours after the predator is gone, they will wake up, okay, and they will go back to their herd. And so this is exactly what happens, you know, when people are diagnosed with cancer. They go into this functional freeze. How do I get through this? How do I manage all of this? And sometimes it's only after they've finished their treatment that they actually experience the emotions, and then they wonder, am I going mad? Because why am I feeling this when everything is all clear, or when I'm coming out of it? But what really is happening is that they're just like the animals, where they're thawing out, and their body is strong enough to hold these emotions now, and so they're having the emotions. But unfortunately, you know, family and friends, they're in a place, oh my God, now everything is over, we can get back to normal. But they have to go through this emotional adjustment. Does that make sense?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I think a lot of people listening will be able to recognize exactly that.
And this is where ARC, you know, will, you know, this is what really, the one reason why ARC was, you know, across the road, you know, started is in order to help people to manage this, you know, to manage this emotional, you know, experience after they had a diagnosis of cancer. Because in order to come out of shutdown, you know, we have to find a way back into social engagement. Okay. And, you know, with COVID, social engagement, you know, was restricted for a lot of cancer patients, so that they weren't able to be able to do this. Okay, and what, you know, this is what we call the polyvagal theory, and I'd love to be able to go into it, because it's the latest research that's been done on our nervous system. Maybe I can give you some information on it. It only exists in mammals because we began to hold our young. But what it does, it is when we're born, we have it in our system. It's another part of the parasympathetic nervous system. It's another way we slow down. Okay. But and so when the baby is born, the nervous system is there. But it has to be developed, it has to be in some way, sort of encouraged. And this is what we do with babies. We rock them, we talk to them, we sing to them, because the ventral vagal nervous system is in our face, and then touches, the sort of the lungs, the heart, and the gut. So in other words, Michelle, if I'm looking at you and you're very as you are today, you are so welcoming, okay. And so therefore what my system picks up, that a message is sent to my heart and my gut, and everything just slows down. And it's a much quicker way of slowing down than the reptilian response will offer you. Does that make sense? And it's something that we really need to be aware of, and again, how do we orientate towards it? And we orientate towards it when we orientate towards something that's safe, when we talk to a trusted friend, when we are in an environment that feels safe. And I think this is what a lot of nurses provide in hospitals. Does that make sense? The smile on the face, the empathetic active listening. And that then, helps the patient to calm down. Does that make sense as well? It's what we do as therapists as well, is provide that safe place where people can tell their stories, okay, without being judged, when we can support them in whatever way that we can in getting them, helping them to get through this. And it's one of the reasons why, in ARC, counseling is one of the things we do in ARC that is helpful in that way.
Yeah. Right. And I think as well, like you said, when some people do finish up treatment and they leave, the day unit or wherever it is, they're leaving that safe space, and then all of a sudden they're on their own. So,
absolutely,
and that can be very, very difficult. And that's when they can feel, I think, the most afraid, because they don't have that comfort of coming in and getting checked up on. And like you said, seeing that friendly face or discussing your worries, all of a sudden you are on your own. So I do think it's so important for people to
look
at the services that are there, because they're so important.
And also you can see how COVID has inhibited that, where they couldn't see their grandkids, they couldn't see their children, they didn't have that support structure around them. And so this ability to calm and soothe themselves just wasn't as available to them. They couldn't be visited in hospital. All of that played a huge part in this,
We'll get back to that conversation in just a minute. I just want to take a moment to talk to you about hay fever, something that I have suffered with for many years now. Are you concerned about the overlap of symptoms between hay fever and COVID-19? Did you know that you can contact your local CarePlus pharmacist over the phone for advice on how to distinguish between the two, and for recommendations on the best over-the-counter treatments for your allergies? You can also check out our helpful guide on CarePlus website, which is careplus.ie, that shows which symptoms come under which condition. Now back to our conversation.
Another thing, I suppose, associated with stress that we hear is panic attacks. So why would people get panic attacks, and how do you think they should manage them?
Yeah, it's a very good question, especially in connection with cancer. Okay, the reason why people can have panic attacks is that it's one of the symptoms of coming into your emotional body again. Does that make sense? Because your body's beginning now to have some of these emotions. And because the body is beginning to have some of these emotions, you will find the heart starts beating faster. Okay. And your breathing kind of gets quicker. And often what happens is it happens in the middle of the night. And so that comes from the fact that they're also dreaming. And that's one of the, you know, dreaming is one of the ways we process stuff. So they find themselves waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, the heart is beating fast, you know, the breathing's got really quick, and they're having, you know, they're having an emotional, you know, a real strong emotional feeling. And then our mind comes in and interprets it.
Mm.
Okay. And say, oh my God, I must be having a heart attack. Oh my God, I'm going to faint. Okay. Because my breathing is that quick. And it's that connection that causes the panic attack. Okay. So because I'm thinking about the symptom, then there's a more adrenaline put into your system.
Mm.
And because there's more adrenaline put into your system, your heart beats faster. Okay. Now, then your thought pattern is, oh my God, I'm definitely going to have a heart attack.
Yeah.
And so you have this loop that's feeding itself. Okay. And often the only way out for that sometimes is the body to faint. Okay. And what we need to do when somebody has a panic attack is to try and can we cut the connection between what they're thinking and their body connection. Mm-hmm. It's the last thing you need to be doing in a panic attack is getting a person to know to connect with their body. What you really need is to ground them, is to bring them into a reality, is to hold them. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. You know, that old version of breathing into a brown paper bag, you know, when we're hyperventilating, was because there's a lot more carbon dioxide being, you know, sort of you're in your system now, and you will automatically take a deep breath, you know.
Yeah. So actually, just to make sense of it, for myself, so it's, you're actually having an emotional experience.
Yeah.
But your brain is basically trying to get you out of that. So they're trying, that kind of goes into fight or flight. Is that right?
It's almost like, you know, in a sense that the loop between what you're thinking and what your body is feeling just feeds itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just feeds itself.
What you need to do is get really grounded in the present moment.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Distract yourself.
Yeah.
You know, if you feel the sensation coming on, you'll start thinking of all the birthdays, you know, of all your family. Get a book and read. Talk to the person beside you. Yeah. Or if you feel that it's, you know, you're constantly feeding yourself, just get somebody to support you. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Even drinking a glass of water, just getting somebody to ground you in the reality is the way to do it. But it is a most horrible experience for people. All right. And it is a symptom of what we call post-traumatic stress, because we now know that cancer diagnosis is a trauma.
Yeah.
Okay. And it is one of those symptoms of it. Okay.
So if I'm with Mary and they're having a panic attack, I suppose I'm just thinking, like what you said, sometimes these can happen at nighttime. And if I'm, you know, with somebody in the room at nighttime and they start to have a panic attack, really just try, like you said, a glass of water and just really bring them back down to
ground them. Yeah, as much as you can. Hold their hand, talk to them, distract them, you know, tell them that they're going to be okay, that this will pass. Does that make sense? That's the problem. We feel that it won't pass because our mind is telling us something else.
And I don't know if this is okay to ask, and we can cut it out if it's not, but I have a friend who has quite bad panic attacks when she drives. Would you have any there's a certain place that she would get very panic attack where she would have a panic attack. Would you have any recommendations for that?
You know, if we can in some way bring a person into feeling and activating the ventral vagal nervous system, okay, then we can actually bring that panic attack down. Okay. Because I have a friend who's similar. Every time she goes on the M50, she feels panicky. And so, you know, Peter Levine developed, and Stephen Porges, who are the people who are really interested in the ventral vagal nervous system and doing a lot of work on it, they, you know, sort of discovered that there's a certain vibration that if we say it if we use it, it has the immediate effect of activating the ventral vagal system in our gut. Okay. So would you like to try it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. It is this, you're using the word VU, okay? But make it, when you're using the word VU, make it as a traveling in your mouth, okay? All right. So you'll take a real deep breath in, and then you go VU. Then you take another deep breath and you go voo. And then take another deep breath and go voo. Oh, do you notice anything?
Feels good.
Do you feel good?
Yeah. It does.
It's a very simple thing, and they've, you know, and it works. And this is what my friend does. She, she's driving on the M50, and she's vooing all the way down.
Oh my god!
And she says she can do it.
Yeah, I think it'd be great if people would, you know, try these things, you know, because I think there's a lot of people automatically go straight to medication when they think anxiety or panic attack. Sure. I know there's so many different things that you can do, I suppose, beforehand as well. So it's great to hear about these little tips and tricks that people can try, you know, and you said, like they can be natural reactions to like a post-traumatic stress and things like that. So to normalize it and to say it's okay that this is happening, it's not uncommon, and that you can get past it is so important to say, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and you know, that's one thing that you know that I've noticed as a therapist, when somebody comes in and talks in that way, you know, I'm totally emotional. I'm finding I'm having, you know, constant crying, you know, bouts, you know, my husband doesn't know what to do with me. I'm in the supermarket and, you know, I'm just crying for no reason because I've dropped something. And I say, you're normal. That's fine, you know, because now your body, you know, you're well under recovery because your body feels strong enough now to have all these emotions that you couldn't have when you had your diagnosis. And so that's okay. And, you know, just let yourself have them. And if if you need further help, then go to counseling and they will provide that atmosphere for you to be able to sort of talk through this. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's all about compassion, isn't it? Like, your body doesn't lie. If your heart is palpitating or you're feeling emotional, like, it's just compassion, isn't it? That's what you need at that moment.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing how many times these people have tremendous compassion for other people, but have no compassion for themselves, you know. Yeah. You know, I think it's very, very important for, you know, to have that compassion for yourself and empathy for yourself as well, too. Yeah.
Interesting you say that, Mary. I always think the people that I don't worry about are the people who upset and they tell you how you feel, or that you know, they do have a cry or they get a bit angry. The people that I really worry about are the people who don't, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, because they're afraid to be vulnerable, you know. And you know, and they may have had an experience for being vulnerable, you know, they didn't get what they needed. And so it's very hard for them to trust, you know.
I suppose moving on from that, Mary, would you have any advice, I suppose, to deal with uncertainty around cancer diagnosis, and I suppose COVID as well? There's a lot of uncertainty with both of those things.
Yeah, I mean, you know, uncertainty, God, it is the word that we kind of use quite a lot now, isn't it? Especially with COVID. And I suppose we just have to be aware that in some way the world is constantly changing, and it will constantly change. And it's not perfect. And our nervous system is designed to be activated on a constant basis, to be able to manage the uncertainty. But, you know, as Brian Keenan said, in the face of threats to his life, do you remember Brian Keenan, who was kidnapped? He said maintaining some sort of control, no matter how small, was essential to his emotional well-being. So when he was able to, when they came in and told him to sit, he stood. When they told him to stand, he sat. When he told him to eat, he wouldn't, because that was the only thing he could control. And so therefore, you know, neuroscience has proven that when faced with stressful events, those with a strong sense of internal control produce far less of the stress hormone. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. And we may need to find a way of managing our uncertainty in that way. Okay, and that is about learning to adapt. Okay, Darwin's theory, wasn't it? Wasn't the fittest or the most intelligent that survived. It was the ones that survived were to adapt. And I think that's maybe, to me, is probably one of the major ways of managing uncertainty is, okay, what can I control? And don't get caught up in what I can't control, and how can I adapt, and what resources do I have, okay, to help me to manage that, to look out for those resources, to look for help, and to look for support when we need it, okay, and is to realize that, and we're going to find this with COVID now, is that when people start going out, when the restrictions start, lessening, thank God that they are. But they will go out now, and things will be unfamiliar again. Even just managing small talk again is going to be different for us. And so we will have to learn to adapt to a new normal now when we go back out. Okay, yeah. And that's going to cause a lot of problems.
Yeah, we're starting to see that anyway, aren't we? Like a little bit of angst, I suppose, amongst people of everything. I think we've adapted quite well to this way of life, I suppose, haven't we?
And we've become institutionalized to it, if you know what I mean, as well, too, and we're going to have to find ourselves coming out of it, that's going to be difficult.
I even hear it with my friend group, they're already anticipating their schedules getting busier and their weekends being kind of taken up again. And you can just see it among people, can't you? Yeah. It's a strange thing to watch, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Mary, I suppose one very important group that we never want to leave out when we're talking about stress and stress management is the carers or a loved one who's looking after somebody who's going through cancer. I think oftentimes it can be extremely stressful for them, but they might not feel they're able to show it because they're trying to support somebody through it. Do you have any advice for people who are caring for somebody with a cancer diagnosis and how to manage their stress?
The carer is often the invisible one, you know what I mean? If you are a prime carer, or any carer, not even just the prime carer, you need to reach out and get support, so that somebody's supporting you as you are supporting the person who has got the cancer, okay? All right. And I think that's really essential that you resource that, that you find those areas, because you need to be out of the whole cancer dynamic. Does that make sense for yourself? And also, I think it's important thing to know as a carer is that, we learn how to care from our childhood. Does that make sense? So the way we've been cared for as a child, we will think that's the best way to care. But must remember that we're all will have, experienced different ways of caring. Mm. So, so therefore, you really need to communicate with the person who's got cancer. What does caring for you really mean? Does that make sense? Because they might think they're doing the greatest job and they're the bee's knees in the cat's pajamas, but they're not doing what the other person wants.
Yeah.
And there is a huge need to have that communication between, the person who's caring and the person who's got the diagnosis of cancer. Okay. Mm. And they do really need to, and especially the person who's the carer, they are often the only link to the outside world.
Yeah.
And the person who has the cancer, is imprisoned in her solitude, and especially during COVID, and they need that experience. Does that make sense from the outside world? And the person who's a carer needs to bring that in. But if both of them have got stuck in the dynamic of the cancer, then they're both drowning in it. I don't know if that makes sense.
I suppose give from as much as you have in your own cup, isn't it? So it's so important for the carer, because they're caring, they need to make sure that their cup is filled
absolutely
as high as possible at all times. And the only way they can do that, like you said, is to reach out for help.
Yeah, And to say what they need. Does that make sense? I mean, I've often heard people, you know, with and carers, you know, they said, you know, people come around and we've got a whole freezer full of lasagna. You know, and we don't like lasagna. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Rather than saying to me, look, this is what I'd like you to do. Would you come in and do the hoovering? Would you pick up the kids? Would you do that? Does that make sense? You know, would you bring me out for a cup of coffee?
Yeah.
So I'm out of the house for a while. Yeah. These are the important things, you know, that the carer needs.
Thanks for that, Mary. I suppose another thing that we see is like we call it scanxiety. So if you're managing anxiety from scan to scan, and it can be, it's so stressful for people, you know, and there's a big build up to these scans, you know. So is there anything that you would recommend to help manage this?
Yeah, you know, I'd hate just to say that it's normal. Does that make sense? And we're back again to what the nervous system is saying. Now the scan is the threat. Okay, so what's going to happen is you're going to go into the fight and flight response. You're going to go in to, you know, having that whole experience in here. And now what's happening also is, you know, we go back to the limbic brain. Now you have the worrier. Okay, and when you have a cancer diagnosis, the worrier is let out of the cage. You might have had a worrier prior to cancer, okay, but you were able to manage it in some way. But when you've got a cancer diagnosis, it comes out of the cage, all right? And so, you know, between the time they get the date of their scan and the date they have their scan, and then they're in the limbo waiting for results, the worrier takes over and creates all kinds of scenarios, worst case scenarios of what might happen. So the best way to do that is again what I'm saying here, you know, earlier on is you know, can I, you know, get resources that will distract me, okay, you know, prior to the event. So if I know my scan is going to be next week, I will make, you know, to make sure that there's people who are going to interact with me between then and that time. So I don't sit and sort of ruminate about it. Does that make sense? Okay. Mm-hmm. When you're going for your scan, all right, my suggestion has always been is that, you know, we have this tendency, you know, I have to park my car the nearest thing I can get to the hospital, if you know what I mean. You know, it's like me in the supermarket, you know, if I don't get it right outside the door, I'm not, you know, it's no good. It has to be the nearest spot. Okay. We just have a tendency, and I have a tendency to do that. And so what I would say to them is don't do that. Okay. You know, park your car about 10 or 15 minutes away. So you're walking to the hospital, and by the time you walk to, you're getting rid of some of this adrenaline.
Okay,
all right. Now if you're going for your scan and you go in and somebody says, hey, you know, we're running late, we're not going to be seeing you for another 3/4 of an hour, you go off, you don't stay, you know. You walk around, because if you sit there, you know, what are you going to do? You're just going to ruminate, and there's nothing to distract you. So you're going to be constantly, you know, sort of working up that and activating that the fight and flight response. So I always say to them, you know, even if it's just to walk around the hospital, don't have any coffee, because that will just, you know, increase it with the caffeine. And if you're able to, and they can tell you, look, it's definitely going to be 3/4 of an hour before you have your scan, then go out and come back in 3/4 of an hour.
Yeah.
Okay. Rather than, you know, just sitting there and just waiting for it. And then, you know, when you come out of it and you're in that limbo, your place is again, try and as much as you possibly can to distract yourself. Don't allow yourself to be sitting, you know, ruminating, you know, about it. You'll really put in few things that will distract you. You know, having that social engagement, you know, where people will make you feel a little bit safer, having that distraction, all of that will help you. But, you know, I'd love to tell you that there's something, you know, that you could do that will just take away from the anxiety, because it's quite normal and that's it. The only other thing I would say to you is that, you know, breathing techniques are brilliant in a situation like this. We do know that when you slow your breath down, you also activate your ventral vagal nervous system. It's a bit like the VU bit, but not as loud, you know what I mean? You can do it silently. But, you know, unfortunately, when we talk about breathing techniques, you know, we often only work with the breath in and then the breath out. Okay, now, if I ask you, you know, Anne-Marie, to take a breath in, I don't know where you are in your breathing. Yeah. At that moment, and so I might be actually, you know, encouraging you to hyperventilate. Okay.
Yeah.
So what you need to do when you're doing some breathing techniques is to breathe out first.
Yeah.
And it's almost like a sigh. Does that make sense? And we do know that even that breathing out, you know, allows you to go into, you know, what we call this more calm, you know, put on the brakes. You know, I like it to think of putting on the brakes. It just slows you down. Now, what I would encourage you then to do is to pause. Because what we have a tendency to do is, you know, when we're doing breathing techniques is I breathe and I count. Okay. Mm-hmm. But, you know, You. What's more important, we're realizing now in trauma therapy is that we need to get used to the impulses in our body. Does that make sense? The communication of our body. So if you breathe out, okay, and then you just pause, and you wait until your body tells you to breathe in, and then you take a full breath in, okay, and then you pause. Okay, again, and you wait for the impulse for your body to breathe out. And if you did that cycle of breathing out, pausing, breathing in, and pausing, if you did that for three cycles, I guarantee you that you will bring your nervous system down and you will bring your anxiety down and you will be more present.
It's a good tip because you can really do that anywhere. You know.
Absolutely anywhere. Yeah. I mean, the VU, I think if you all started doing VU in the waiting room, they put you into St. Pat's or they bring down the psych department, you know? Absolutely. Yeah. But maybe breathing would be a better option there, you know?
Yeah, it's good. I'm just thinking, well, I suppose I'm really thinking of myself here, but if I'm nervous or anxious about something, it will always come at nighttime because, like you said, you can distract yourself during the day, you can socialize. Mm-hmm.
People. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Distract yourself, but it's really at nighttime I find that if there's something on your mind, it really takes over. But simple breathing, I suppose, like you said, is so easy. You're not going to disturb anybody else who's with you, and it's just something you can control yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you see, conscious breathing means my mind is conscious of the fact that I'm breathing.
Yeah.
So therefore, because you're conscious, you know, of your breathing, you can't be thinking at the same time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it has the automatic effect of you know, distracting yourself from the ruminating that's causing, you know, as you say, that panic. Okay, and what it's doing is that, you know, you're also, you know, connected to the sensations of the breath in the body, and those that kind of combination sort of really really works. You know, yeah. I would do that kind of breathing, you know, constantly throughout my day.
Yeah, I actually do it quite a lot, and you do automatically feel a difference when you get a couple of cycles in. Like it is an automatic thing. Like, I mean, it doesn't take away all of your stress and anxiety, but it definitely calms you down, and it brings you back into the room for sure.
Absolutely, more present. Yeah.
I suppose another thing, Mary, that we see is an anxiety around, I suppose, cancer treatment can sometimes change the appearance of people's bodies. There's anxiety about socializing again, especially after COVID, you know. Do you have any tips about coping with this?
Yeah, that's a real difficult one, you know, and sometimes, you know, especially for women, we identify a lot with our appearance. Does that make sense? So that, you know, when you're going to lose your hair and, you know, and you're going to have maybe lost weight and your pallor is different, that this might cause a lot of social anxiety about, you know, people going out socializing. You know, we in ARC, you know, we have sort of lots of courses, you know, around that. Does that make sense? That, you know, Boots come in and they do a whole course on appearance. And, you know, anytime, you know, well, this was pre-COVID, and I'm not too sure. I think they might be still doing it. They might be doing it on Zoom. But, you know, there was so much fun and laughter coming out of that class. Does that make sense? Because because, you know, people were beginning to, you know, look at their appearance in a different way, and they were getting techniques to manage the appearance during a sort of, you know, all the effects of the cancer diagnosis. But the other piece I would say to people as well is to realize that a lot of people will have empathy for you, will have a great understanding. Does that make sense? That, you know, of what you're going through, okay, as well, too. And we might think that they notice things about us, but I've often sat with people with wigs and, you know, and they have, you know, put lovely pencil where their eyebrows should be. And I'd be quite surprised afterwards that they tell me they've got a wig on.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, we're thinking that people notice this, but they don't, because what people are more interested in is having a conversation with you. You know, and you know, just are just so delighted that you can engage with them, you know, and that you're able to do that. And also the other piece is to remember that, you know, it's also showing that how strong you are. Does that make sense? It's also showing that I'm here and I am working through this, okay, and that I have the resilience, you know, to work through this, you know, and that I'm able to do this. And it's again what we you know, we talked about before, is that our nervous system is designed to come out of our comfort zone. We, you know, it's designed to do that. And when we don't do that, we get bored, and that's more stressful.
Yeah.
And one thing I kind of see sometimes for patients is they can find it very stressful deciding who they want to tell about their cancer diagnosis.
Yeah.
The dynamics can be complicated. Like, I want to tell this sister, but I don't want to tell another sister. And it can cause a huge amount of anxiety. Would you have any tips for anybody who's feeling stressed like this, or how to possibly overcome it?
Yeah, and that's a real big thing, because, you know, also when you're diagnosed with cancer and you're going through treatment, you're tired, you're exhausted, your tolerance level is low, you know, as well too. So I mean, I think, you know, it's important that you designate a PR system in your family. Does that, you nominate somebody in your family that is your PR, and everybody comes to them, and sort of they're the ones that tell everybody. Does that make sense? So that you're not the source of information, because otherwise what happens is people get constant messages, you know, and they can't, and they're not in a place to answer it. But if they have this person, you know, this is who you go to, okay? You go to Michelle. Michelle has, you know, will know exactly where I am, what I'm doing, and she'll let you know, and, you know, she will, you know, and have her tell the rest of the sisters, the cousins, and all of that, because otherwise it is exhausting, and it's also emotionally exhausting as well too. And I think also, you know, what can often happen, and we experience it quite a lot in the counseling, is that the person who's diagnosed with cancer doesn't want to tell anybody.
Yeah.
And if that happens, then the carer has no resources.
Yeah.
Because they can't go and look for support, because they can't tell anybody.
Yeah.
As well. And sometimes that isn't very helpful either, you know.
I think that's a really important point to tip off, isn't it? Because it's common enough, you know. We do see that, and it's a huge weight to carry. Absolutely. I suppose we know from talking to yourself and a lot of your other colleagues in ARC that you offer a lot of support, but you did mention that there is a stress management program. Could you just tell us a little bit what you offer, I suppose, in terms of stress management in ARC?
Yeah, we have at the moment we have on Zoom, okay, an open stress management course and a closed one. The open one is on a Tuesday morning from 10:30 until 12:30. I start the course with a breathing and a grounding exercise that I encourage people to practice, okay? And then each day I will bring in a topic. And it, you know, the talks, I think, there's about 9 in total, I think. I talk about, you know, literally a little bit more than what we're talking about today, about the whole anatomy of stress and trauma and the impact of trauma on cancer. And I also then talk about the limbic brain in great detail of what, why, as you so nicely asked the question, why do I get stressed out when somebody else doesn't? So I put almost a microscope on the limbic brain, and we kind of see, okay, well, what am I contributing to this? Okay, because if I can figure out what I'm contributing to it, then I can change it. And so I then, you know, kind of have a look at, you know, techniques that will help you to challenge, you know, this thinking system. Does that make sense? You know, how do I challenge these thoughts? So we have a great discussion and talk about that, and I bring in some information about that, and then we talk about boundaries, okay? Because I think boundaries are huge stress, especially in a cancer diagnosis. You know, in other words, you know, how do I relate to you? Okay, and you know. You know, where do I begin and where do you end? And how do I relate my, you know, beliefs and cultures and my sense of myself with you? Because often that breaks down in a cancer diagnosis. So we work through that, okay? And then, you know, it's like, you know, when relationships are not working, we might often have conflict. Okay, and I think stress, you know, conflict causes a lot of stress. Okay, and so we look at the different styles and healthy styles of managing conflict, and how do I work with them, and then, you know, what is my relationship with my anger? You know, can I do I have a good healthy relationship with anger? What happens when somebody's angry at me? Okay, how do I manage that? So we kind of work with that, okay? The other topic I bring up is sleep. You know, and I think you've mentioned it here as well, too, how sleep, you know, is really affected when somebody has a diagnosis of cancer. And so we look at, you know, the anatomy of sleep and why do we sleep this way? And, you know, I give sort of 10 tips of how to manage your sleep better and why you should be sleeping that way. And then, you know, we talk about self-care. You know, what does actually self-care mean? Okay. I even, you know, even pose the question, you know, did something good come out of my diagnosis of cancer? You know, did it, you know, what kind of benefits did I get? Was I able to say no for, you know, to somebody, which I would never have said before? Did I decide that I'm not going to do that particular thing anymore? And some people say, I'm not going to go back to that type of a job again. So in other words, they give themselves permission to do something different. Okay. And so we explore that. Okay. And then, you know, because I feel that you're on a course like this, a stress management course like this, you know, you've inviting yourself to make changes. Okay. But the process of change is very, very difficult. So I go through the process of change and what is necessary to support them to do the change. Okay. So that's the open one. And the closed one is kind of, do you want to work with this in a deeper way? And so we, you know, in the open classes, we could have anything up to 20 people on the Zoom. But in the closed one, we bring it down to a smaller number so people can look at these issues in a much deeper way and how they apply to themselves. You know, and we do, even in the open one, I encourage people to bring issues in and to talk to me because, as you can see, I can talk, you know, around the subject for ages, but it's nice to have particular issues to sort of, you know, focus on.
Great that you have those options, because, you know, if you're just thinking, oh, is this for me, it's great to say, okay, I'll drop into the open one and mm-hmm. then see if it's for me, then you can maybe transition into the closed one.
Absolutely, yeah. Or in the open one, you could, you know, you could miss a day and then come back and you know, we keep repeating those talks so that you can always come back and pick it up again. So that's why we have the open one, especially, you know, during COVID, you know.
No pressure on them that way as well.
Yeah.
Mary, this is brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary.
Not at all. I'm hope that some some people may get something from it. Okay. And it was just lovely to be here with you and to share this information with you. And as you say, you know, I'm in there in ARC and as a counselor and on the stress management. So if anybody's really interested, you know, connect with us, you know. Brilliant. We're there to support them, you know.
Thank you so much. I think people are going to benefit so much from the information you've put out today, and it's been so clear and concise and still covered so much. So yeah, we really, really appreciate it.
Really, yeah. Do.
Thanks for listening to the Answers for Cancers podcast. Please share this podcast with anybody who you think it might help. Also, if you can like and subscribe, it lets people know we're here. You can alternatively contact us on Instagram at @theanswersforcancers_podcast. And if you have any questions on anything that we discussed today, please email us at theanswersforcancerspodcast@gmail.com